Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com. Meet and Three is back. We're kicking off our fourth season and celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary with a very special episode about our home, Brooklyn.
Roberta's was such an interesting place with such a strong gravitational pull. It attracted all these different groups.
The neighborhood has changed a lot over the past decade, from its culinary renaissance to the complicated implications of gentrification.
I would say the majority of the people who are members of our co-op definitely have a certain purchasing power, are mostly white, and we are trying to change that.
We're taking you on a journey that spans the birthplace of food radio to buzzy neighborhood pollinators to the transformative health journey of our borough president.
That was my moment of, you know, wow, someone has thrown me a life raft and I'm going to take it.
Subscribe to Meet and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz, and I am so excited to be back in the Heritage Radio Clubhouse with my main man, Jeet. Jeet, it's so nice to finally meet you in person instead of just talking over email. But man, what a New York day. I'm so excited to be back in the city that doesn't sleep, and I remember why it doesn't. We have a great show for you today. Diego Moya, chef at Racine or Racine's, depending how you want to throw that S at the end, New York, is here in the house. He's going to talk about growing up in a family that cooked and had restaurants and him finding his own love of small restaurants. And then we have Storefront, which is as Brooklyn as you can get for a New York band. I love it. I'm here. Here we go. Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
I wanna build it so it's the car, but it's gone. I'm not tending to stop. Thanks, and now let me know. Well, okay. Well, they'll get back to me though. You sweat into the
so much.
Oh my God. Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. I forgot about the incredible Roberta's Pizza hospitality. And now we have a full bar here too.
It's nice.
It's nice. We're dipping into the Wolf whiskey.
What do we got?
Wolf.
Dire Wolf. We'll call it Dire Wolf whiskey.
Dire Wolf whiskey.
In celebration that we got. I guess when this airs, this will be the last episode of Game of Thrones.
After?
It's airing in a week, so here we go. But yeah. Diego Moya, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hey.
Here, well, cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers a little whiskey.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. So you grew up, you were born in Chile,
mm-hmm.
grew up in Long Island.
Yeah.
Parents had a small pizzeria.
Yeah.
What was that like? Were you tossing dough with them? Were you in the mix?
Yeah, I mean, it was basically kind of just like coming home from school. Like, I never really went home. I had to go to the pizzeria, you know, mix the dough, make the sauces, hang out with the guys that were back there, just kind of like, you know, kind of like pirates, you know, like with their dirty yellow t-shirts and, you know, all my notebooks were covered in grease. And it was really kind of like... Yeah, it wasn't a normal childhood, but it was, you know, for me, it was really special, really exciting.
What made it so special?
I think, like, I just really liked to work. I didn't really enjoy much going home and just, like, writing in a notebook or doing some math. I preferred to just, like, get my hands dirty and, like, get through the day and then go home and take a shower and go to bed.
I mean, starting that young, what are some of the lessons that have followed you through now your professional cooking career?
Well, I mean, I think it's like, it's twofold. I think the work at that point in my life was very much just work. It wasn't really part of the conversation of me loving food. I think I knew even at that age when I was really young that like that food was something that I really wanted to do creatively, artistically, at that age. Obviously now I have a different outlook on it, but you know, it's like, you know, in the end, it all kind of like meets an apex and you realize that it's not really artistic or craft, or it is work that you do, but, you know, just feeling out how to spend a day and get something done was the most important part of that time in my life.
Now, obviously, food is so different of what it was then, growing up working in a pizzeria in Long Island, and the through line of saying, I'm starting in a pizzeria as a teenager and I'm going to go on to be a professional chef is not probably what it is today. Because kids today could be like, I started a pizzeria and maybe one day I'll own my own place.
Yeah.
So how much did your parents encourage you to keep with cooking with food or support you in your decision to become a professional chef?
Well, they were pretty good, actually. You know, most parents, especially immigrant parents, are like very much like, we did this for you so you can just like become a doctor or a lawyer. And they gave me a little bit of that, maybe for like a year or two. And then after that, they were like, all right, well, we obviously know this is what you want to do. You know, we couldn't afford for cooking school. I'm sorry. And then it was like basically just save your pennies and figure it out.
And figure it out you did, because you eventually, as you got older, made your way to France.
Yeah.
To cook with... just this guy, Alain Passard. He's this... I know not a lot of people know who he is.
Yeah,
some of our listeners might know who he is.
Some people might know, but...
But how do you go from Long Island Pizzeria into one of the most respected vegetable-driven restaurants in the world?
What I... So, it's kind of like a weird story. So...
We love weird stories here.
So, you know, like... The story that you hear a lot from chefs is like, oh, yeah, we fell in love with, like, watching great chefs of the world and, like, seeing how, you know, all these amazing people are kind of just, like, you know, doing these great things and these old men with their toques and all this, you know, this fun stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That I would watch when I was coming home from school when I was young. Since I couldn't afford for school, I figured I'd just take a leap. So I started saving some money and then threw myself at Paris and sent... you know, letters to everyone.
And real letters, legit letters.
Real letters, you know, written on stationery, the nicest I could find, and, you know, and followed up with, like, you know, maybe 40 or 50 chefs.
Wow.
And he was the only one that responded.
What do you think made him respond?
I think, at some point in the letter, I think I wrote something about loving pulling radishes with my grandfather when I was younger. And I think that might have been what did it.
I mean, vegetables have been a really big part of your career and vegetable-driven stuff and working with farms. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship that your family had with you and vegetables and sort of implementing their importance on your life?
Well, you know, as I was younger, my grandfather was a farmer for the majority of his life. He was this kind of like big figure that eventually moved out of farming and like became more successful, had a construction company. But that kind of like installation of like knowing that you have to have a connection to the ground and how that translates to flavor was almost before cooking. I have a real direct passion to sustainable agriculture and permaculture and things like that, where like it's more about the earth, and then like you end up getting to work with those kind of things as a cook. And that's the connection that I saw in Alan, and that he was just basically just his creativity came from the ground. It didn't come from some technique or trying to be creative or trying to be something different. He just felt inspired by the vegetables.
Working there has to be both an exhilarating and humbling experience. What do you remember from that time? And are there any stories that stick out that you say, this was a definitive moment of my time working in that kitchen?
Yeah, it was definitely difficult. It was a tiny, tiny kitchen. I think I've worked at delis that were bigger than that kitchen. It was really special because I think the most special time that I had there, besides a few dinners that we did at their farms, were what was actually the morning. You know, getting there at 6 a.m. and like seeing the vans pull up, and the quality of the produce was just like, it was basically like these like little jewel boxes that were tended after like as if there were like, you know, diamonds, you know, everything packed neatly and beautifully.
What year was this?
This was in 2004, I think.
So that idea of farm to table and vegetable driven food was out there, but not like it is today.
No. I mean, this was only a few years after he decided to go all vegetarian. So it was very much,
in the smallest sense, was a complete shock to the entire restaurant world.
Well, it was a shock to France first, I think.
What was it like being there to feel those reverberations of this chef who said, we're doing vegetables first and only vegetables first?
I think that like in a way, it was really special because he was so gung-ho about the idea. I think he was so confident that I don't think anyone on the team felt that it was something that was like out of this world. Like he just knew.
And how does that inspire and stick with you to see this chef who has so many accolades, so much recognition, and for him to do something so bold, especially in France where meat is such a giant part of the culture? How does that inspire you? What stays with you after seeing a chef like that and working for a chef like that make that decision?
I think it's, you know, it's bold. And I think that anybody that cooks, anybody that opens a restaurant, in a metropolis, like you have to have the stones and like the ability to go your own path. It's not always easy, and especially with like the way it's getting harder to open restaurants and like the expenses. New York is getting expensive, San Francisco. Like to do something different is very difficult, and you really have to have a vision, and you have to stick with it, and you might fail. But he did it on the highest level, and it was, you know, you really can't fault him for it because he was successful, and he
still
really,
is.
He's still successful, still killing it, and he's just, you know, an amazing person to be around.
So after you spent your time in Paris, what prompted your decision to leave and then to travel the world? Because you went to Peru, you were in Chile. Mm-hmm. What made you want to travel the world and cook in different kitchens?
I think I went back to South America just because I wanted to get a feel of the cuisine. Chilean cuisine is kind of like, it's hitting a little bit of a mark right now, but when I was there, it was very, very basic. Peru has a very rich, you know, culinary history, and I learned a lot there and got to spend some time working with some really good chefs down there, but it was basically just to touch base with home.
And what did you learn when you were there, even though it was not at the same high level of gourmet that you had just come from? What stayed with you? What did you take with you? What was important about going back home and cooking?
I think we all kind of have like some sense of home and what we want from our memories. Even though I left when I was really young, like these memories stick with me and these flavors stick with me. Not that I necessarily use them a lot at this point, but the seasoning and the vegetables and, you know, it being the home of all these amazing vegetables that we use now, like tomatoes and potatoes and all these things that have been used for so many years. And, you know, there's a good reason why it's so delicious and why they've had so much time to develop these flavors is because they've just had enough time.
Right. So you're in South America cooking around. What is that siren song that brings you back to New York City?
New York.
I mean, fair. That is, yes, you are correct that you can answer that question with the question. But what eventually, because you came back to the city, you didn't go back to Long Island, correct?
Yeah.
But what was the opportunity? What made you want to come back to New York? I mean, this was, what, late aughts? So like 2010?
No, it was 2008, 2009.
I mean, New York was, and again, we talked about highs and lows in New York, but New York was on the top at that time.
Yeah, yeah. It was starting to get, I mean,
it was hot.
There was all these, like, you know, small explosions happening in Brooklyn.
We're sitting at Roberta's. Yeah.
And, you know, I was here for a short while, like, when it was, like, really, like, raucous and fun and, like...
You got one story from the early days of Roberta's?
Oh, yeah.
Give me one.
I think I passed out in the garden, like, at 7 in the morning and woke up at, like, 8 in the afternoon once. Yeah, it was like a long sleep, and it was a
deep sleep.
Ridiculous night.
Oh.
Yeah.
I know what nights you're talking about.
Yeah.
But so that energy that brought you back here, what was inspiring about it, but also what were you bringing with you from your past experiences?
I think that, like, you know, the stuff from South America, not so much. It was just kind of more of like a soul-searching thing. From Europe, you know, it was Elan. It was the quality of vegetables and stuff that I hadn't seen in New York. So when I got back here, I realized that I wanted to work with some like fine dining chefs, and like I really admired that route. But more than anything, I wanted to work with guys that were kind of like New York restaurant people, you know.
And what defined that for you as like a New York restaurant person?
I think like a guy that's been here, probably grew up in the neighborhood or like in the area, that's been around for a long time, that had a 50-seater. You know, that was a sous chef for 7 years. I wanted to work with that kind of guy because I wanted to open a restaurant that size. So you can't learn that from the fine dining guys.
No. Listen, we're going to take a quick musical break because we're going to talk about you working some of the smaller restaurants. And then we're going to talk about Racine, New York. We have a song from the musical archives coming to you live from the studio in Brooklyn here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Yeah.
Back to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Aaron Bresnitz. So excited to be coming from the belly of the beast at Heritage at Roberta's. Mm. We have Diego Moya, chef at Racine's in New York. So you're back in New York, you're cooking around, and one of the things that I've noticed about your history of cooking and restaurants that you've worked in is that you really were drawn to these smaller places. Now New York has some famous giant rooms, your Budokans and your things like that, which you can learn a lot from like a volume point of view and a money-making point of view. But what drew you to those smaller places, those more chef auteur driven restaurants?
I think it's like it's basically, I think originally it was educational, just so I can learn how to do it, because I knew I wanted to open a restaurant and I was gung-ho about it in New York. And it's not the easiest thing, so like, why not learn from the guys that are doing it like on the grassroots without much money? And then it was kind of like cuisine driven, and you know, I just knew that, you know, I knew this guy Harold Dearly was on Top Chef, and
shout out Harold.
Harold, you know, like still a good friend of mine, and like, you know, a fishing buddy, and just like an amazing guy, and he was doing something different with Thai food, and like I wanted to see, you know, how to use those flavors. And then after that, Casamono for a bunch of years.
I mean, Casamono was one of the hottest restaurants in New York at the time.
I mean, if you actually draw the distinction and you go back through the timelines, the trend of like small shareable plates that, you know, Estella does, and
sure,
you know, all these restaurants,
Four Horsemen,
it basically started there. And you know, obviously with some parallels to Spain, but like that model began there. And I remember all these chefs coming in and just spending time there and trying to learn the model. And
that is the nicest way of saying stealing.
No. No, because you can't steal a model. No,
you can't steal a model. You can't.
You can't steal a model. All right, but
let me ask you this.
Inspired.
What is it like to be part of us? Because you're at Roberta's and you're at Casamono. You're with Harold. To be at these restaurants that are just, in the lamest of the words, I can't think of any other word, but just hot. Like, they are the restaurant. What is it like to be at the center of that? And not just like a hanger-on, but to be one of the guys putting up the food, doing the shopping.
I mean, I honestly, like, I haven't worked at a slow restaurant besides, you know, the one that I opened,
which was
But like,
shout out to Hemlock.
Shout out to Hemlock, but all the rest of them have been, you know, just kind of like these machines that just like roll through it. And because they're on the, you know, on the thread, it's amazing. You get to meet all these people, all these chefs, and you do food that kind of resonates. And, you know, at each of these restaurants, I've tried to push it more.
Part of what you also built being at these restaurants is a network and connections with farms.
Yeah.
And having respect for that. And, you know, New York, now it's a given that New York restaurants are going to have a relationship with farms.
Yeah.
And they're going to have this reciprocal relationship where they're on the menu and things like that. But when you were coming back, getting started, it wasn't always a given.
No.
So how did you build those relationships, and what really drove you to build those relationships?
Well, I mean, you know, the quality of produce and less so the quality of protein, you know, I moved that way at some point, but the quality of produce has always been like a real focus for me. And the reason why I took the job at Casamono was because I met Anthony Sasso, the chef at the time, at the Green Market. And I was going to go to Per Se or somewhere else. And he rolls up with this janky, like, you know, Red Rider, like cart with sunflowers and anise hyssop and heirloom tomatoes and all this stuff that I got. He's like, why don't you just come work for me for a while and just hang out? And I said, I'd be stupid not to.
No.
And then I just basically spent like every week there, every day a new dish, and every day that the market was open, it was a block away, you know? So yeah. Like I could literally have family meals, shoot out, grab some stuff, and then come back and do a dish.
And how was that inspiring, what you were putting up on the menu, especially since you were doing these smaller shared plates? What flexibility did that give you?
Well, it gives you the flexibility that you can just run specials and that, you know, you price them out. You don't really have to worry too much about how they fit into the menu. And the menu there was like Spanish, but also eclectic. And we just were able to have fun with it and very focused on Good Farm. So not once was it ever a question that the dish wouldn't fit on the menu.
I mean, when you're working off this farm-driven menu, how much of it is really developing and refining a dish versus just taking exceptional produce and just doing as little as possible to turn it into a dish?
Well, it takes time. I think at that point in my career, I think it was much more about developing a dish using something. Now, absolutely not. Whatever comes in, we dial it back and we look at what the ingredient is and we just like go straight forward with that idea and we don't take any time to develop. We just do it.
So what allowed you to have that confidence to just celebrate the vegetables that you have? Is it confidence in yourself? Is it just knowing how to treat vegetables? You know, because sometimes you could be like, well, yeah, those are radishes that have been sliced and served with butter. I mean, I could do that at home. But, you know, what's allowing you to put your mark on it and still have a mark as a chef and saying you're doing something to the ingredient with as little as possible and still just saying we've cooked this?
I love you for that question. So so there's a couple of things. I think that, like, in the past 3 or 4 years, especially with Hemlock, we all sat down for a couple of weeks and we talked and we really wanted to kind of like get more introspective on the vegetables. We wanted to find out how we can season using the vegetables themselves, how we can ferment, how we can use scrap, how we can use flavors that are adjacent, herbs that are traditionally part or seasonings that are part of these dishes traditionally, but using them in an interesting way. And it's like at Hemlock, we were doing it like very, very seriously. We were like maybe using one hint on a dish. Now I'm kind of like a little bit more loose with it, but it creates like a new tool set for things that you can do to accentuate things that have been around.
Interesting. I mean, it's amazing how you get older and as a chef and you go, we need to respect what's coming through the back door, through the suppliers more and more and more, instead of me just being like, this is just a tool to me to write my own thing, to show how much I can do.
Yeah, like it's not about you. I mean, there's so many chefs. I'm going to shout out to Jeremy Fox because I...
Shout out Jeremy Fox.
He's,
great episode.
Yeah,
great. Go into the archives.
Yeah, check it out.
Check it out.
You know, just because, like, you know, he was one of my inspirations, but when he had Ubuntu, and at the time I had a life-changing meal where he wasn't trying to, maybe he was trying to show off, but he was doing things in such a simple way that I felt that what better way than to create these small pockets of deliciousness just using whatever you have simply without trying to exacerbate it with any kind of fireworks.
I mean, it's that editing, right?
Editing.
It's the editing.
Simplicity. Which is so hard.
It's so hard. So you had Hemlock for a little.
Mm-hmm.
Which...
Damn, what a footnote.
Look, I don't want to breeze past it because I do want to get to
receive. No, yeah, of course. Yeah,
but,
of
course. You know, how do you deal with that? Like, you had a clear vision. You knew exactly what you wanted to do. The pedigree says, is this going to work? But then you're also in New York, and that means... You know, nothing's guaranteed.
Yeah, you know, it was like a short swan song that like kind of just got was underfunded and I had to let it go. And, you know, it happens. It happens to so many people. It happens every day. I'm not special because I closed a restaurant, you know. It's just like you have to move on and figure out the next one.
And the next one was Racine.
Yeah.
Or Racines.
Racines.
However you want to say it.
Racines.
Racines. How did you get involved in there? What made you want to get in? Because, you know, that had its own pedigree. Yeah. You know, the guy before you was this little known chef. No, Paul Lebrun. Like,
yeah.
You know, watch for him. He might be coming up next.
He's on his way up.
But how do you go to this restaurant? How'd you get involved? And then obviously something that already has a trajectory, a reputation, a menu. How do you come in, respect what's happening, but also then make it your own?
Yeah, that's a very complicated question.
It's softballs at the beginning, and then we work our way up to hardballs.
Nice. So I'll make it kind of cut and dry. So like at the time, I was kind of heartbroken because the restaurant closed, and I was trying to find out the next move. I had some offers, you know, some hotel stuff and, you know, some smaller stuff, some things that were maybe like in the pipeline for a year away.
Sure.
And like, you know, we're in New York. We got to make money now and, you know, pay that damn rent.
You got to pay that rent, pay the bills
and pay for your whiskey. And you know,
look, you get a show at Heritage, you work for 10 years and then a bar shows up. That's how you pay for the whiskey.
Nice.
But so the opportunity comes.
Yeah.
And because he had the menu up until December 31st of last year, mm-hmm. right? So how'd you get involved? How do you want to start respecting his vision, but also start making it your own?
So we were in talks like maybe like 2 months before then. It was pretty quick. Alice Firing, who was like, for me, like the goddess of natural wine. And she tells a story about natural wine. I'm a huge fan of wine. She helped me out of Hemlock for a while. She put me in touch with Pascaline. And Pascaline Lepelletier is like probably the hottest figure in wine right now. Actually, she's in France right now getting her MOF.
Damn.
Which is like, you know, like the cute little like, you know, blue, red, and white thing that they put around their collars.
Yeah.
Huge deal.
And if you don't know, you look at it and go, oh, that's a cute little neckerchief.
Yeah.
That's a cute little thing.
No,
and then for those, you know, you go,
it's
goddamn.
Like, it's like literally like the best of your craft, you know. It's like humongous honor, and she's a rock star. And I decided to take the job mostly because of her, because to work around a wine professional like that is like very rare, but also like a kitchen that was kind of like figuring itself out, didn't really have an identity. I had a lot of cooks like that were waiting on the sidelines to do something fun, so I kind of like just grabbed the opportunity to pull them all in and then work with her.
And so it's very wine driven. I mean, the cellar is insane. You're working with one of the most impressive wine people in the world. But you also have your own pedigree of working at these incredible restaurants, working with vegetables, having a clear vision of what you know, what you like, and also loving these smaller restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
So how did the marriage work? How did you come in? What did you bring in? What did you say, this is what I'm willing to accept from your point of view, because you're already a restaurant, but this is what I need to say to make it my point of view as a restaurant.
You find the balance, and like, you know, it's sometimes a little bit tricky to understand that you're not the, at least at this point, I'm not the boss. So I, like, they've given me full reign to do whatever I want, and the food has kind of like angled slowly at the beginning towards like slightly French and French accents, but in all honesty, all the food that's done in New York, almost down to like, you know, the pizzeria is French driven in a way.
I mean, so, you know, ever since World's Fair,
yeah,
and all the French restaurants came over in the late 1800s, New York's never really escaped that French driven idea at the highest level, and then also at the what you discovered in Paris, just the little jewel box of vegetables showing up at restaurants.
Exactly. So it's all like, it's all really French, and they've been pretty understanding with that. And as we've been moving forward, I was playing around with a lot of French flavors, but now I'm kind of just like pushing more to do things that are just like more of my style, more delicious and more focused on the vegetables, and trying to find that balance of that Tribeca crowd.
So, you know? What's a perfect night for you? Set me up with a perfect night at the restaurant.
Perfect night. We have a a great balance of like industry.
Yeah.
Rich people. So like you know, big spenders and big wine spenders, wine heads, and also young kids, because I had that crowd at Hemlock, that right. very like young foodie crowd.
I feel like Hemlock was that punk band that broke up.
It was like a B-side.
It was a B-side.
Deep cut.
That kinda, people love.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, I'm going to follow that chef to his next thing because yeah. I was a Hemlock head.
Yeah.
And now he's over here and we're still getting riffs of that.
And it's like a little bit more Tony, but like it's like, whatever. Okay.
Nothing, okay. Look, people say Tony like a bad word, but Tony's fine sometimes.
When you get older, Tony's great.
Tony's great. Tony is fantastic. Yeah. So it's a good mix. And you're still working with a bunch of local farms, right?
So even more so now, actually. Like, I've developed those relationships, and now we've figured out how to, you know, really pull almost only from them.
That's amazing. What's your footprint? 20 miles, 30 miles, 50 miles?
I mean, I don't really put a number to it, but it's about, I would say it's about 40 miles.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty good. And then we also have a good friend of mine that makes wine. He grows vegetables for us, and that's special, you know.
That's amazing. You have people making specific things, growing specific
yeah.
things.
Yeah, we did like a seed catalog thing 2 years ago, and we're like still going.
And now it's about to be spring summertime in New York.
Yeah.
That's when it really shines.
Oh, man, it's great. Like, you know, coming into a restaurant in the winter for the first time with a new menu with my style food is very difficult.
But it gives you a good way to just sort of establish yourself and yeah. not get distracted by, oh, we got to get these carrots on. Oh, we got to get the tomatoes on. Oh, we got to do this.
No, yeah.
It's just, you're like, we got potatoes. We got strawberries.
You set up the menu. It's very basic. But, like, you know, we really tried to, like, hammer, at least with a few of the dishes, that it was my style. And some of the dishes I placating, like, the crowd and, like, the style of the restaurant. So we've developed this menu, like, so far. And I think it's like, going pretty well.
Awesome. Well, Diego, thank you so much. If people want to follow you and the restaurant, where can they go on social media?
Diego Moya on Instagram. I've been around since the beginning of Instagram.
Ooh.
So I think...
Not just hot to the restaurants, but hot to the gram.
Hot to the gram. And in Racine's, New York, check it out and come in and
coming for and a wine, a vegetables. Yeah.
Yeah. We have a little kitchen counter and... You know, you can come to the bar, you can come with your mom for a big table. It's like a pretty big
I'm pretty restaurant. Sure that the best seat in the restaurant is at the bar, couple of plates, glass of wine.
Well, the kitchen counter so I can hang out with you, and then for sure you'll have a good experience.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Cheers. We'll do a little chin-chin on the whiskey.
Chin-chin.
Boom, boom. We're going to have another song from the archives, and then we got Storefront Live here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thank you. perhaps I've been lonesome and landlocked, and I thought of you all the while.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kotbock cave-aged cheeses, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Sari Kamen.
And I'm Leah Kurtz. And together we host Food Without Borders here on HRN.
Immigrants make our food system vibrant, diverse, and delicious.
Each week, we invite a guest to talk about how food connects them to their past as we explore what it's like to be an immigrant in the U.S. today.
You can find Food Without Borders wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes, coming to you from the legendary clubhouse behind Roberta's. We have Storefront in the studio. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for having us. To WSNKY.
To what?
I mean, I was just trying to do, like, you know, when you hear a radio.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what would it be? Like, WSNK?
I guess it would be WHRN for Heritage Radio Network.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. Coming to you live from WHRN.
Hi, this is Storefront.
This is Storefront.
WHRN.
So for those who are unfortunately in the dark and not on that hot tip of the New York scene, who is Storefront?
Storefront is a band comprised of me, Amy Rose Spiegel, the lead singer, Peggy Wang, who is our bassist and kind of our guiding force.
Chalky, can we say White, spiritual guru?
We can't.
Oh.
I don't think we can.
Okay.
But what we can say is that Peggy is the reason for this whole band.
She's the raison d'etre.
Yeah. That seems more accurate
Fair
to
enough.
Me. Chalky White, who is our fabulous drummer. Brandon Loro, guitarist, and Bobby Marshall, also a guitarist.
We are big fans of a good New York five borough through and through band. At Snacky Tunes. But what we love are really the reasons of why these bands decide to come together and form as one, like a Voltron. What is your reason for existing? Why do you guys love being Storefront?
I'm going to throw that one to Peggy, I guess. Because I think you were the locomotive, I think, behind this.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the truth is that we did meet through work, and this is something that we do outside of work, which everyone needs.
Yeah, so Peggy and I had worked together when I was like 22 years old, and I had just gotten my first office job ever, and I was really nervous about it, and I fucked it up a lot. I would always get in trouble.
Everyone should be like, in their early 20s and fucking up a New York job.
I agree, but like I was just really going for it. Like I would come to my office job in like a bathing suit and a fur.
Where were you working?
I was working at BuzzFeed, where Peggy was. Like,
that seems appropriate, founding, right?
I thought so. I thought so. It went okay. So Peggy and I met there, and Peggy very kindly took me under her wing. And how did we actually start playing together? I don't know that I remember as well as you do.
I think I heard you sing. You were singing something random in the office.
Should have been fired.
And
yet another reason.
And I was like, wait, do you sing?
Yeah.
What's up, girl? Do you sing?
It was literally, what's up, girl? Do you sing?
We were already friends. So.
Yeah, I had really taken to Peggy because, as you can see, like she's a really charming person. And I think in an office setting, you don't often come across a really charming person. So we'd been kicking it. And we started playing music with my friend John, who moved to LA. And we had a band called Task. And the band called Task was a nightmare band.
Is that a genre or a noun?
I can say that we coined it. Like, we would get into like this tiny, dingy practice space every Saturday, and one of us would lie on a piano. We drank like a fifth of whiskey every single time we practiced.
Right.
But I mean, like, John moved away, thank God, and then years later, like, that's my best friend. I just saw him, but like, that was a scene in a time. So then Bob, I was working at this other place and like as a music editor, and I was in Chicago at like a VFW hall. Do you know like a VFW hall with that?
Absolutely.
Is?
It's where we went to shows when we were growing up.
Sure, of course. So like we're at one of those, and this man, our guitarist Bob, comes up to me and he's like, "You're Amy Spiegel." I was like, "Yeah."
Yeah. Damn right.
Continue to be. And he was like, "You got me wasted when I got my job at BuzzFeed, like you took me out."
Is that the same wing that Peggy took you under? Is that a different type of
it
wing?
It was a Bob, what do you think? Like, what happened here? You take it from here.
What was it? It was literally, at the time, Amy was dating a friend of mine from college. I had started playing music a little bit with Peggy outside of everything, and we didn't have a singer, and so I had met Amy like randomly at a bar, and Amy was just like, "Congratulations on BuzzFeed. Do you know Peggy Wang?" And I'm like, "I do. She's great." And she's like, and Amy was like, "We know all the same people. Let's like, I'm gonna get you like very drunk." So she did.
Yeah.
And then later on, when Peggy and I were starting to jam and talking about a singer, she's like, "Oh, this Amy Rose Spiegel would be a great singer for this." And I was just like, "Oh." I met her once at a bar, and then.
But sometimes that's all you need in New York, is that we had one night together, and it's one of my favorite nights in New York.
Oh yeah, it was 100% one of those like random nights. And then we're at some party at a VFW, like Amy was saying, and I go to my girlfriend, like, "Oh, that's Amy Rose Spiegel. Like, she got me drunk once. I have to invite her to be in this band." And so I just approach her randomly and say, like, "Peggy thinks that you should be in a band with
us." So it was random with intent.
The pitch was Peggy. That was like definitely the pitch.
You can sell me on anything if you started with Peggy. Like, even when we were recording our EP recently, Peggy and I were joking. I'm always like, "Yeah, my really cool friend, Peggy. Like, I'll do anything for Peggy. Anything Peggy says, I'm just like, yeah.
I feel like anything for Peggy is the real benchmark of making it in New York.
I agree. I could not agree with you more. It's been years of that for me.
Awesome.
So thank you.
All right, let's rip into a song. Storefront, what do you got? What's the first song?
Should we do... Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
So this one is called "I Love You Like I Say I Do."
Awesome. Well, here we go. Storefront, live on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
On the phone, say I do. I love you like I 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 say I do.
Awesome. So being in New York, starting a band, what is it like to start a band in New York these days?
Fucking sick. I would recommend it to everybody.
Is it the best side hustle that you can do?
Oh, it's not a side hustle. Unfortunately, I think it's different for me than maybe some other people in our band, but like, it's really just like having a group of best friends that you can go and write things with, and eventually like something. Oh, you're like, oh, I have to play a show, or like put on an EP, or like whatever. But it's really nice. Like it's, you just hang with your people. Somehow it was easy for us, though. What do you think, Bob?
This is the first band I've ever done in New York. So I know Peggy and Brandon have done other things, but had other projects in New York, but I think the weird thing that doesn't really get talked too much about starting a band in New York is like how expensive it is compared to like anywhere else in terms of like recording, in terms of like,
it's about space, right?
Space. I mean, like, because, you know, especially if you're growing up and you're like a kid, like I did in the Midwest, like everybody has a basement.
Sure.
So, or everybody's parents has a basement.
Or garage.
There's space to put stuff. And here there's, you're always like trying to find just any place to like be able to actually spread out. And like, we're a 5-person band. Like, we were just looking at our practice space that we're like, oh, I don't even know if all of us can fit in here. So it's definitely like very different than other cities I've been in bands in. But like, it's also, I think like the idea of being able to play like really fun shows and like the venues we've been able to play at is like so awesome. We're playing tomorrow at Baby's All Right, which is like the first venue I was ever taken to in New York when I moved here, like my first like weekend here. So
Where I got you drunk?
Yes, that's actually where Amy and I first met at Baby's All Right.
Shout out to Babies. Love those guys.
Love those guys too.
So when you start a band in New York and you get super excited about it, how long is it in 5-person secret incubation? Like, we're just having our own little secret band before you start telling people about it.
If I had it my way, nobody would ever know about us. So I think I feel differently maybe about
this. It's a secret.
This. Yeah.
It's out of the bag, I guess.
But what do you do? I mean, like, how long do you practice, come together, work on your craft before you start telling people about it? Or is it you form a band Saturday and Saturday night at the bar, you're like, yo, I'm in a band?
Oh, I brag about us constantly. Like, I was bragging about us, like, before we wrote a song. I was like, this fucking sick band, Star Front. Like, you know, we didn't even have a name at that point. But I don't know. What would you say to this, Peggy?
I mean, I feel like it just comes up. I don't, like, try to, like, seed it intentionally.
Well, thanks a lot, dog. Sorry. See, here I am, like, out here being like, Peggy is, like, my heart and cool spirit. That's my guiding light. That's my fucking lodestar.
Peggy's like,
Peggy's like,
chill.
I don't tell anybody.
Keep it chill, Amy.
I know, that's our whole thing. So Peggy, that's usually the dynamic, actually.
Yeah. You guys have actually recorded your first single, and you guys have recorded a full EP, correct?
Yeah, we have.
When did you realize that you were ready to record that first song? When did you start feeling that you had written something that you wanted to share with the world on a permanent basis?
Brandon, I feel like you know this.
Sure. So, I don't know, once we kind of gelled and we had some of our own material after, you know, a few months of having a good time and really kind of just getting to know each other, I'm, you know, one of the newer people in the mix, although Bob and I met years ago, but I feel like we
we recorded a little kind of quick session, like where we rehearse, with a, you know, very slightly different lineup. And I think once we heard just the raw cut of that, we were like, maybe this is something more than just, you know, a couple hours in Bloody Marys over the weekend. So,
are you sure?
I mean, Bloody Marys, I've heard about this about you guys. Bloody Marys is a big part of your rituals.
It is. Absolutely. Our blood type as a band is Bloody Mary.
Oh, so it's part Worcestershire.
Well, yeah, so we practice at the sweatshop. There's a bar right near there, and they serve
shout Bloody them out. Marys. We love them.
They're called, it's called Tradesmen.
Yeah.
Tradesmen, shout them out.
Love them.
Love them.
And they do Bloody Marys until 4 p.m. So sometimes I leave early and gotta grab that bloody, you know? So
I
Peggy's like, fuck this practice. Like, yeah. I really gotta go to this bloody.
Hey guys, and the bartender's it's 3:52 and I'm trying to get there by 3:59.
It's literally that. Peggy will drop her bass and run. Like, it's like that.
I had a disgusting trend of a while back in my days in Brooklyn of asking for Bloody Marys at nighttime bars.
Oh, that is gross.
Is that not okay?
It is not. I mean, the looks I would get said that it was not okay, but I thought it was okay.
I don't think it is.
I don't know.
That's some warm Bloody Mary mix there. That has like a little bit of like a culture on
that's,
it.
That's why ice was invented for that reason. all right, let's hear another song. Boy.
Wait, guys, can we do Rip the Price Off instead of We Girls Ate? Please? Would that be okay? please.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, cool. So what do we got?
This is a song called Rip the Price Off. I think it was one of the first songs we wrote together.
Sweet. All right, here we got Rip the Price Off.
Okay.
Storefront, live on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Off. Who knows what you cost? As a moth and a dove, a bandit on an animal, recouping the loss foretold by my parentage. And I'm not paying off the balance on my credit card. I'm inexpensive and I'm dirt cheap. Sometimes I'm just dirty. Shower if I got a meeting. Think I'll ever get the job. When it comes to my job, look, I suck up. I don't try too hard, even writing the song I wanted to do. The bare minimum, recouping the loss foretold by mine. I'm not paying off my credit cards. In my defense, it's not so easy to be broke and lazy. Money's boring, cheap is free, rotting out the verve of me. I'm inexpensive and I'm dirt cheap. Sometimes I'm just dirty.
Going back to D-Dog.
Yeah.
There's a funny story as we all jam on pizza here about all of you guys eating pizza before your first show.
Yes. Oh my god.
What's the story there?
So the thing about this is we record sometimes at Peggy's house like just to like fill in vocals, or like we'll go and practice there. And we were playing a show at Transpicos, which happens to be very close to where you live. And it was our first show ever, and anybody in this room can tell you that I get really fucking nervous before anything. I flip out a little bit, so Peggy was like, let's go.
Not just shows?
Everything. Everything.
Were you nervous before this show?
Yeah.
I was really nervous.
Yeah.
I'm still nervous before every show.
I know. So we went back to your house, and you and I were freaking out and doing our makeup, but like, set the scene. It was great.
I don't know. We were like applying highlighter to our faces.
Peggy and I were like perched inside of her sink while the dudes were eating pizza. And Brandon, God bless Brandon, our guitarist, one of our guitarists, was just like, Brandon is like my heart and cool spirit because he can see me get nervous and he can watch my face freak out. And like I lock eyes with him whenever we're playing a show. And I'm just like, all right, just like take me through it, whatever. Brandon, tell us about what happened here because I was blacked out nervous.
I don't know. You exuded confidence. I think
you're so nice to me.
What a nice. That yeah. is correct. That so, is the so only we, answer that is correct.
I know. They're like, honestly, that's what it's like to be in a band. Is just like people telling you shit about yourself that isn't true, and then you make it true.
Oh my god, no! It was totally awesome. Fine what you did last night. That was totally great.
I mean, these dudes last night had. I went to go like run errands, and apparently, like a storefront had like a lost Friday night that I wasn't a part of. Peggy, can you summarize what happened?
Yeah.
This morning I had a text from Peggy that was like, can someone get my bass? I don't know where it is.
Dog.
But it was also like, it's going to make it sound like the bougiest band because we were like getting really drunk on chilled orange wine.
Totally fine. Totally fine. That is an acceptable answer in 2019. So let's talk about 2019 and what you guys have coming up. You have an EP coming out.
We
correct.
Do. And I would love to quiz your listeners as to whether we should call it Organize Your Workplace or Just for the Summer.
Oh, all right. So just to be clear, the only listener
we know.
That is going to respond is my mom. So she will pick the name of your
wait,
EP.
Wait, can she actually do a write-in then?
Yeah, we'll have
wait,
to do
can
a
your
write-in.
Mom write in our EP name?
Yeah, well, I'll ask my mom.
We don't know
mom.
What to call it.
Yeah, mom, if you're listening, when you're listening, please pick the EP name.
Wait, does anybody else in this band have a strong opinion that they want a voice for the record?
As I like Just for the
I feel
summer,
like Chalky
actually.
Does. But.
Just for the Summer, by the way, is a fantastic EP name for a New York band. I'm just going to say, I'm going to throw it out there that it doesn't really get better than that for New York vibes, New York bands.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I think it's like our guiding principle as a band right now. Like, you can do anything just for the summer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
It's what is it, a May to August romance?
Yeah, I guess in this case it would
by
be.
By the way, that's a freebie if you want that one.
Whoa, dog. We're like Dashboard Confessional now. Sick.
Finally.
Damn. All right, should we play a song? What's up? What
no,
do you
I
want
got
us
one
do?
More question, and we'll
yeah,
play one last
oh
song.
My God. Give us your question.
Your group text is called Dark Wine as a band.
It is.
How did that happen?
Bob?
To Bob.
Bob, we're going to throw that one over to you.
I feel like we're just going to come off like alcoholics on this show.
It's you're a young New York band. If you're not alcoholics, I don't know what you are.
I feel like the doc, like I should show this like my doctor or something and ask him if he thinks I have a problem. But it was another day at a Tradesman. And I was drunk and I didn't, and Amy, I was getting wine for Amy and Peggy and I didn't know.
This is my favorite shit.
I forgot that like the options are like red and white. So I asked them, do they want like a light wine or a dark wine?
Fair.
The best.
Fair. That is
the actual best.
That is an actual term in the wine world.
No,
dark
no,
wine.
You didn't even ask light or dark. You asked, do you want a white wine or do you want a dark wine?
All right. So if people want to follow you on Instagram or social media, where can they find you?
They can find us at Storefront. NYC at Storefront NYC, or they can find me at Amy Rosary, Bob at Baby Bobby Marshall .business.net.
.gov.
Yeah, yeah.
.geofront.
Peggy is at Pebstep. Chalky and Brandon abhor social media. So like, that's basically where we're at.
You know, I think it's good that the band is split on some people being on social media and some people not. I think it's good. I think if you're on social media, it doesn't really work.
Huh.
Yeah.
It keeps the wine dark.
Yeah,
keeps that wine dark.
I think it ruins your guitar playing if you're on Twitter.
All right, well, listen, I want to thank Storefront I want to thank Diego Moya. Thank you to Jay Strell for setting it up. Thank you, Jeet. I'm so happy we finally met in person. Shout out to the entire Heritage family. Greg, wherever you are in the world.
We love you so much, Greg.
And
we miss
to
you.
My wife on Mother's Day, I love you so much, Anna. And to my baby girl, Josephine. This has been Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. Mm-hmm. What's the last song we got going?
The last one is called I Would. We're also taking suggestions from your mom. It's a title. Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day to everyone, which will be weird because this show is playing a week after Mother's Day.
Mom.
Mom, here you go.
It's late, but here we go.
Thank you so much. And here we go. Storefront on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Catch us on Halloween as the Lemonheads. Shout out Evan Dando. Shout out PJ Vogt. Shout out Greg Bresnitz. Where are you? Like, yeah. Shout out Baby's All Right.
Thanks, guys. See you next week.
See you next week.
We talk about food. We talk about music. With musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you.
For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.